Hey, John.
Hello, Drew, my friend. How is it going?
Hey, are you selling tickets?
Shh. Of course I'm selling tickets. What do you want?
You've got Van Halen tickets?
Ooh. No go on the Van Halen, man. All tapped out. But let me tell you something. I got something very special just for you. Come here a little closer.
All right.
I got these two tickets right here.
Yeah?
For Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
I'm Drew.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to The Hourchive.
Our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time.
Okay, here we are. 1982, retrospective.
Retrospectacular.
Retrospectacular.
Way to ruin it, Drew.
Here we are. 1982. Retrospectacular. We'll
One
cut that
time.
First part out.
One more time.
But I got it right.
No. I'm saying, yeah. This
the
is
last.
The, this
of,
is the final yeah. 1982 retrospectacular.
Yeah. And it's a fitting episode. It's a fitting movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it rolls right off of...
last week's episode,
yeah.
The 50th and year anniversary episode.
Yeah.
The subject was high school.
And the subject of
today
our movie
is high school.
Yeah.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
This was my pick. Drew,
yeah.
You had not seen it. Yeah.
I had not ever seen it ever.
Yeah, and you initially... I mean, this not that this is any different than previous instances, but you were hesitant about this one initially when we first discussed this idea.
Yeah,
like months ago, you were like, "I don't really want to watch that. I don't want to watch that either.
I don't really want to watch that."
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
No. Why would I want to watch that?
Yeah,
give me a break.
I don't like movies with subtitles and black and white.
You know, it's funny because, like, all three of the movies, other than Grease 2,
mm-hmm.
I was very hesitant to watch.
Yeah. You were, yeah. I'm very excited about Grease 2.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's funny because this, like, I don't know which one of these came out first.
Oh,
I don't know if
right.
Grease 2 came out after
right.
Ridgemont. I'm not sure. We should look into that.
Yeah.
But I didn't see Fast Times when it first came out.
In 1982?
1982. I would have been three, I think.
Right.
So I couldn't see over the seat. but I remember, I think I saw it, I think I watched it on TV, or parts of it on TV
yeah.
later, and then didn't actually see the full thing until maybe high school, maybe college. I don't know.
Ugh.
It was late. I came to it late too.
Not as late as me.
No, no. How do you feel about that?
Fine.
Good. First impression. What was your first impression?
I liked it. I thought
yeah.
it was great.
Good.
I thought it was really good. And I was thinking about it later and the few ideas about why I like it we can get into, but I was like, yeah, this is worth all the talk, like
yeah.
it lives up to the reputation as being, you know, a sort of stand apart movie.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it when you think about like the 80s high school movie,
yeah,
I feel like Breakfast Club is probably the one that immediately comes to most people's minds as like the quintessential 80s high school movie.
I guess.
But I kind of think that, I mean, it's apples and oranges really with
yeah,
Fast Times, but
Breakfast Club, there's very little high school
yeah.
in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, there's very little high school in Fast Times too. I mean, it's
yeah.
there's maybe like three or four.
Yeah.
Scenes,
yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I guess what I mean is like, with Breakfast Club, what you have is individuals who represent a greater, a larger group, right? Yeah. And that's the whole premise, is that they are a jock and a brain and a princess. And, you know, they're like ambassadors for their cliques, right? And that's the interaction that you get. But Ridgemont is much more, here's the student body, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You'd see a lot of people.
It's got to be like the first high school movie, like of that era.
I think so. I mean, I think the only other movie that may have come out before it was Porky's.
Okay.
Which was actually, I think that's a college movie.
Isn't that a camp? No, Meatballs.
That's Meatballs. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. I think it was the first of its kind.
And that is evident. I assumed that before. I mean, I knew because of the nature of our structure here that it was made in 1982. But when I wasn't really thinking about that, and I was just thinking about the way this movie sort of portrayed high schoolers. And I was like, this has to be like the first high school movie of its kind, and the reason is because I found it really interesting that there were no, with the exception of Spicoli, mm-hmm. and even him, I'd argue to some degree, there are no caricatures in this movie. Mm-hmm. These are all, like all the characters are sort of real people.
Yeah.
And I say that Spicoli is not necessarily a caricature because he was the first of that character.
Kind of established.
Yeah, so you can kind of argue that he is not necessarily a caricature of anything.
Right.
He is simply a representation of that, you know, person.
Yeah.
For whoever, for what's his face who wrote it? Cameron Crowe.
Yeah.
But I was really struck by like the apparent lack of specific high school stereotypes.
Yeah.
Everyone seemed like they were on equal footing in that movie. It was so strange. I kept looking for the conflict.
Yeah.
And there's like almost no conflict between the students.
Yeah.
And there's really only one source of conflict, student versus teacher.
Right.
It's funny, like, everyone's in it together.
You could sort of say that there's maybe a bit of a conflict between, like, the cheering squad and the rest of the student body. Well,
that's the weirdest part, too. Like, the cheerleaders are the ostracized ones.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting take. And I sort of, like, I don't know if this was intentional, but I read that watching it again this time, I sort of read that as like a rebuke on Cameron Crowe and Amy Heckerling, who directed it. Mm-hmm. That was sort of like them kind of rejecting those tropes of like the cheerleader being like this is the focus of your you know, high school story, mm-hmm. and completely marginalized.
Yeah.
In this case.
Like, there's only two cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And they get made fun of.
They're mocked incessantly. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was no nerd.
Well, there was the one kind of nerdy
See,
guy,
but that's the,
but,
and that's the
but
thing.
He wasn't
you watch this movie. If you've seen The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and, you know, John Hughes movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've seen every high school movie that's come out since Fast Times. You're like, that's not a nerd.
Right.
He's everyone likes him for one thing. And for another thing, like he's socially fine. Like he isn't socially inept.
Yeah.
And when I saw him, I was like, there's the nerd. Here we go. I found one of the, you know, playing like high school movie bingo, and I'm like, hey, check out the nerd. But then nothing nerdy happened. Yeah,
nerd.
Like
yeah.
He turns out to be someone people like.
Yeah.
So it was really disarming in that respect, in a good way, you know.
Yeah.
That instead of relying on expected tropes of a high school movie, they were just like, here's a bunch of people, you know? and here's how they interact. It was very slice of life.
It sort of makes me wonder if we kind of have to blame those tropes on people like John Hughes.
Right.
You know, like, for simplicity's sake, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, saying, like, you know, he simplified these things.
Yeah.
You know, he sort of mushed these kind of characteristics together and into one person. And
huh. Well, and, they... But they existed. I mean, the... So, Grease 2.
Yeah.
The Grease series. I mean, you got the nerd, you got the jocks, you got the greasers.
Yeah.
Right? You definitely have those established tropes. And...
But maybe not in the context of an 80s high school.
Yes, exactly.
Until John Hughes.
Yes.
Or the fallout from Fast Times.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of fallout, man.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
But it was touching. It was a touching film. Like,
yeah,
there were some real moments in there that I liked a lot.
Yeah, nice.
That was my reaction. That was how I felt.
I have moments too.
All
right, they start right away. Honestly,
yeah,
yeah. Mall. For like a couple of reasons.
Well, the opening sequence is phenomenal.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's incredible. That's easily one of the best opening.
Yeah. What's the song playing over it?
We got the beat.
That's what. Okay, that's what I thought it was.
The mall sort of acting as kind of their, it's almost like the mall in this movie functions as the high school setting.
Yeah, totally.
More so than actual high school.
Yeah.
And I guess the argument there is like, you know, what happens in high school isn't real life.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, what you do in high school, but your real life is really what happens outside of it. But yeah, like, well, the mall as a staple of like the 80s.
Yeah.
Really crystallized in that moment.
What an incredible, such an incredible statement.
Yeah.
Like, they, the, as like the Pat Benatar girls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the, that scene, that opening scene is just great. And, you know, they hit all the characters and sort of what they're up to. And
it's a great introduction, like an overview.
You know,
it's an overture of the movie. Really, you're seeing all of these people kind of, and they, you know, sort of crisscross paths, and you kind of set up relationships. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think it's in that opening scene, and that goes on for a while. That's like a good 10-minute scene or whatever overall. And there's a part where the rat says, he's like, all the action happens on the other side.
Yeah,
of the mall, which. So great. That might be my favorite line of the movie.
He's stuck on the wrong side of the mall.
Yeah.
He wants to work at the burger place, I think.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how, like, the cinema is on the wrong side.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is he talking to Damone?
Yeah.
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 Who Damone. I decided that Damone, if they did a remake of Ridgemont, they should cast Jimmy Fallon because he looks just like that guy. Looks just like him.
Yeah. That guy never did really anything after.
He has a pretty great IMDb photo, though.
Yes, he does.
He's barefoot.
Yeah.
And he's, like, crouching. And he's... it's like a current picture.
Yeah. Yeah, he's still acting. He just hasn't done any, like, really remarkable, noteworthy...
Right.
...singular roles.
And that was a really good role.
Yeah. Yeah. he's one of the people that you come away from it sort of like, this goes for everybody, I guess, but you can kind of, you can see his motivations.
Yeah.
You can understand him. You empathize with him from a certain degree.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're also, you're confronted by, it really forces you to question your own motivations in a lot of ways. Like, because I think you're put into his shoes fairly easily, and then you have to come to terms with how you would address a certain situation. Yeah. You know, he's a great character. They're all really, really good.
And
like you said, they all seem to get along fairly well.
I really liked that. I it's funny because like in a lot of high school movies, there's a clear conflict set up.
Yeah.
Whether it be this group of kids versus this group of kids, or all the kids versus the teachers, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
There's factions. Yeah.
I really appreciated that this was just, you know, a collection of people. Yeah. And there was there necessarily weren't any like staunch conflicts.
Yeah.
There were conflicts, but
yeah, they were minuscule.
Yeah. They were fleeting as they are in that, at that time of your life, you know? And, I really liked that everyone was kind of together.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it was cool. But it was also so weird. It was just, it was this, not knowing what I was getting into, because I assumed this was going to be the standard high school movie.
Yeah.
And that's because everything that I've seen from Ridgemont High has been Spicoli stuff. Mm. And if anything can be categorized as template, he could, you know, because he's the stoner guy.
Yeah.
And so I kind of assumed, okay, well, that's how this is going to be a movie of that, you know, that kind of thing. And he's the only thing in that movie that gets anywhere near that kind of format. And I think he goes beyond it. Like, he's, you know, his character as a stoner, like, his constant state of bewilderment is so charming, you know, and like, he doesn't even realize when he's being persecuted.
Yeah.
And so you don't really feel bad because like, he's not really suffering.
Well, and he's not like, I mean, he's completely honest, you know?
Yeah.
He comes across so genuine.
Yeah.
And I give, I guess, I don't know if that a lot of that credit goes to Sean Penn or if it goes to like Cameron Crowe, you know,
probably a combination.
Probably. Yeah. But he is so well portrayed. And I guess I lean a little bit more toward Cameron Crowe because of the way the situations that he is put into and the way his presumed victory is always undermined a little bit, you know, like you sort of think, because this is a high school movie,
and
a teenager movie, you know, you sort of think that like it's on the side of the teenagers, you know?
Right.
So when you set up that conflict with him and Mr. Hand, you sort of expect that he's going to come out ahead, you know?
Yeah.
Like when the pizza scene is classic because he does the, he's goofing off, you know, and you think like this is hilarious, this is Spicoli, you know, getting the upper hand on Mr. Hand, but he totally turns it around on him. And the very end of the movie where their scene together is awesome.
Yeah,
such a great.
What I love is that scene is like a compromise.
Yeah,
it's not even like a scene where one understands the other, or one's like, you're not so bad, or or like Spicoli suddenly shows that he's been paying attention all this time and he actually knows everything.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, like, it's simply like, you know, we've been at odds through this whole year, and let's even things out. And like, they just kind of have this, you know, few hours together where Hand makes good on his promise that, like, if you waste his time, he'll come and waste yours. Okay. And Spicoli endures it, you know. And then it ends with him, with Mr. Hand leaving and still doesn't get the guy, you know.
Yeah, he shakes his head. Yeah, frustrated.
Yeah, and it's and he just sort of accepts it, you know. He's like, well, I don't get him, you know. And I really appreciated that it wasn't some kind of like moment that you expected.
Yeah.
You know, it was just sort of a, in a way, it was kind of a fizzle to that conflict, which I liked. It was like, yeah, well, they're never going to get each other.
Which is, yeah, I mean,
and they don't need to.
Again, the nature of any sort of like fleeting conflict.
And then he
in
goes to prom.
Yeah.
Hey, I know that song. I love it when he walks into class. He goes, I know that dude.
Yeah. This is American history. It says so right there.
And then when Mr. Hand rips up his schedule, like, what are you doing? He's so confused. Oh, man. That's great.
You guys had shirts on when you came in here. Something must happen to him.
Ah. Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, Stoltz. You check out Anthony Edwards. He was the other guy.
Which one's it? Wait, who's Anthony Edwards?
The other stoner dude.
Who's Anthony Edwards?
Anthony Edwards from Top Gun and ER.
Really?
Yeah.
He's the other stoner dude?
He was the other stoner, yeah.
Wow. I did not notice that.
Did you notice Nicolas Cage?
Oh, yeah, of course I did. Yeah. Of course I did. He had, I think, two scenes.
Yeah, in the burger
place. Where he's, yeah, well, he's in the burger place, but he's also at the pep rally.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah. It's incredible.
Apparently, he auditioned for the role that Judge Reinhold eventually got.
Yeah.
But he, I think he played it too dark or something, they said.
Which is excellent. Reinhold.
Reinhold, he's great.
He is incredible in that.
He again, like all these characters, like I like every single character in the movie. Yeah. Like them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Not there are no villains in my mind. There are people who make poor decisions, but there's no one in there that like it seems like everyone you can't cast anyone as the villain because in nearly any situation where you have two people at odds, both are responsible. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like no one is. Yeah. There. No one seems to be imposing on another person. They're equally making stupid decisions or whatever, right? And so you can't really cast anyone as the villain.
Yeah.
Which I really like. And so, but. Judge Reinhold is just like grinning through that whole movie. It's so great. Oh, I had a question. Okay, so is it Linda? Is that the
Phoebe Cates?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So throughout the movie she's referring to her boyfriend who goes to college in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Is it this is never said or stated, but are you to assume that she is making it all up?
I don't know. I didn't think about that until just now, actually, as you were starting to ask that question.
Because halfway through the movie, I'm like, she's making this up.
Right.
There is no one, especially because whenever, what's the other girl? Her friend. What's her name?
Oh, it's not Stacy, is it?
Stacy? Tracy? Lacey?
Yeah, Stacy Hamilton.
When Stacy is talking about her experiences with both Rat and then Damone, and Linda is, it seems clear that Linda is lying about what she's, you know, experienced by that point. So then I'm like, I think this whole like boyfriend in Chicago is made up. Yeah,
I think you could be right. I initially always took that as, you know, her sort of talking about how, you know, high school guys are so backwards or whatever.
Exactly.
And her comeuppance, I guess, in a way.
Right.
Is that, you know, he's now not interested right. in a high school girl. But, yeah, I think he could be right. I think she could be she could be making it up.
When I was – when that scene happens where she talks about him, mm-hmm. you know, dumping her or whatever, my thought was, okay, this is how she gets out of it, you know.
Yeah.
This is how she doesn't ever have to explain it.
Yeah.
Is that he dumps her. And she can look, you know, strong.
Yeah.
For writing back or whatever, you know.
Very clever.
So I think I think I'm going to assume that she made all that up.
Nice. I like that dimension.
Yeah, yeah.
Whole new added dimension.
There you go, man. Nice.
I'm glad you watched this movie.
So she was a sensation, right, at the time. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was a huge deal, her scene coming out of the pool. And
I think this was maybe her second movie at the time. But, yeah, totally instant
this is
notoriety.
Before Gremlins, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I guess I can see why she would have been, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is a terrible comparison, but I mean, I do feel like she was sort of Megan Fox-ish for the era.
Interesting.
You know, like, she was sort of sold as like a high school sex symbol, you know, to a certain degree.
Right.
But she made an interesting, like, 180, you know, from that.
Yeah.
I think none of her other roles really, you know, fall into that.
But yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is really fascinating in this movie.
It is a weird performance.
Such an understated performance.
Yeah.
But yet so, like, to me, like, accurate. Like, it rings really true.
Well, she's basically the spine of the movie.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like, yeah. you're essentially following her story.
Yeah.
If you were to pick any one character, I think you're getting the most insight into her.
Yeah.
You know, whereas everyone else is not necessarily on the periphery, but.
Well, and she's really the only one who has changed significantly by the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess you could say Brad has too, Judge Reinhold, but.
Yeah. But she has been through the most.
Yeah.
In terms of events
and
sort of experiences. Yeah, totally. And she's just a strange, weird performance. I don't know. Like, it was good.
She's kind of a strange actress anyway.
Yeah.
You know, just in general, but it lends itself really well to this. Because you can't always read her, you know, you can't always exactly.
Yeah. And again, you're presented at the beginning of this film, and if you've seen every other high school film before you see Ridgemont,
yeah,
you're assuming, okay, this is the virgin, the inexperienced freshman who, you know, is gonna make a lot of mistakes and have awkward moments and learn a lesson. And she becomes this incredibly, like, sexually aggressive person.
Yeah.
You know, and also, like, not. She herself, I feel, never acts victimized.
Yeah.
You know, even if she, you know, depending on your perspective, if she was victimized.
Yeah.
But she always seems to be, like, in control of herself.
Yeah.
And a willing participant in the things that happen. And also responsible and and ready for the results,
the
consequences. You know, it's a really
she really does have a handle on what happens.
Yeah, and it's funny because when she starts off, she seems so, sort of helpless and like, you know, because Linda
always under the tutelage of Linda, and yeah,
and I think I don't know if I think at a certain point she realizes that Linda doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah,
you know, because it becomes clear that at a certain point, Stacy has learned more and had deeper experiences than Linda.
Yeah.
And so, she just seems like one of the most, like, has it the most together out of, which is really interesting considering the things that happened to her through that movie.
Yeah.
you know, and the way she's treated by men throughout that movie is just sort of like, I don't know, just she is a real enigma.
It's interesting because she does, like, the circumstances, like, they are somewhat, they're, like, troubling, you know? Like, you want to feel bad for her, but at the same time...
But she doesn't feel bad for herself.
She's so resilient. Yeah. And not even, like, resilient. It's like you never see her cry, I don't think. Yeah,
exactly.
Anything. You know, she's very durable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like, the scene with her and Brad when he picks her up is amazing. That's a great scene anyway. But like even then she's not like, she's never broken really, you know? Which I think that's maybe the one thing, the deeper element of the movie, you know, on the surface, I love this movie because it is so evocative of the '80s.
Yeah.
And because it has all of those great hilarious moments, you know? But that element to it, the way that these characters, all of these things that are such a big deal in other movies, you know, like the thing with the car, the car getting banged up. Yes. I mean, that was a whole other movie. That was License to Drive, essentially. Right. You know, this car is trash and it needs to get fixed. What do we do? And then that gets stretched out. Like that's the entire conflict of the movie. And then there's the whole promiscuity issue and like what comes out of that and everything. That would have been, you know, like a huge deal and has been a huge deal in like other movies, you know. And they just deal with it.
Yeah,
you know?
They just weather the storm.
Roll right through it and they're like on to the next thing, which is awesome.
It's pretty incredible.
So few movies do that.
Yeah.
Especially with like within that realm, within high school.
And it works somehow. Like, I don't know. It's funny because as I'm watching it, I'm like, man, why aren't they more like, this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
and somehow it works like within this universe of this film. Like it doesn't seem unrealistic either. You know,
It doesn't feel forced. It doesn't.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, having never seen it prior to or during high school, I wonder if my perspective on it would have been different then, you know, like I'm wondering if maybe the fact that, retrospect adds some validity to it or makes it work. You know, the fact that you can, if you look at this after high school and you say to yourself, well, right, you know, all of these things that seemed such a big deal really weren't such a big deal. And then you see this movie, and it's much easier to take the fact that they weather these things so well because you weathered them and, you know, you're fine. They weren't that big a deal. But I wonder if it maybe plays differently for somebody who hasn't gone through that yet. I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
I love that moment when Spicoli wrecks the car. He's like, I could fix it. The guy's like, what? No, you can't, Spicoli. You can't fix this. He's like, my dad.
He has an awesome set of tools.
Yeah. And then he gets out and he looks at the hood. And like he gets back in, and I'm totally expecting this line of like, oh, we're screwed. And
he's
like,
yeah.
I can fix this.
He's totally stepped back. Hey, make a right. Right here.
My brother's gonna kill us. He's gonna kill us. He's gonna kill you and he's gonna kill me. He's gonna kill us.
Hey, man, just be glad I had fast reflexes.
My brother's gonna shit.
Make up your mind, dude. Is he gonna shit or is he gonna kill us?
First he's gonna shit, then he's gonna kill us.
Relax, all right? My old man, he's a television repairman. He's got this ultimate set of tools. I can fix it.
Can't fix this car, Spicoli.
I can fix it.
And then he does, you know, for the most part. I mean,
what a genius.
He fixes the problem anyway.
Yes,
so great.
Yes, he does.
That's Forrest DeForest.
Forrest Whitaker.
Forrest,
DeForest.
Forrest Kelly. Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, Forrest
again,
Whitaker.
Like, and he's the jock in the movie. And he's totally not this, you know, dude who goes around like subjugating and attacking others. Like, he's just,
yeah,
he's just a dude.
Yeah,
you know,
he buys tickets from Damone.
Yeah,
yeah.
What does Damone say? He's like, I know this guy.
Yeah, he consulted me when he was buying that car. Fine set of wheels. Or...
Oh man. Damone. I guess we already talked about him, but he's this character that I just did not know what to do with him. You know, at the end of the movie, I was like, I don't know how I feel about this guy.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think maybe the one like time where I felt like the whole weathering the storm thing, I was like, I don't know, mm-hmm. was when Rat is like, yeah, we're still friends, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, really?
You don't see that happening?
Man, I do. I mean, I do. But I guess it really sort of bugged me that it could happen, you know? Because Damone, you know, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
We've been walking around this all through the whole episode. But
yeah.
Damone gets Stacy pregnant. And when she tells him that, you know, he's sort of like, oh, well, you got to get an abortion.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, I'm going to.
That was a great moment. Yeah. She's like, yeah, I figured that out. Thanks. Yeah.
And she's like, but you need to pay for half of it and I need a ride, you know?
Yeah.
And he doesn't. He says, okay, I'll do it, you know? But then it's funny.
He does make a genuine effort.
Yeah. He tries to get the money. He can't get the money. And then rather than, you know, be like, I can't get the money, he just doesn't show up, you know? And so it's interesting because, once again, like, he's technically the villain in that situation, but at the same time, you're like, he really did try.
Yeah.
And being a teenager, he freaked out when he couldn't get the money, and he responded in the only way he thought he could, and that was to not, you know.
I think the difference is that, like, he comes out of that situation negatively.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
Like, it's definitely a negative light, rightfully so, you know,
yeah,
like, cause
absolutely.
he does chicken out, you know,
yep.
He could have been the better person and been like, look, I couldn't get the money, but you know, I'll give you a ride or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the difference is that, like, a villain would not acknowledge their own fault in that. He, I think, regrets what he's done.
Yeah.
I think there's a genuine sense of regret and shame. And I think he's going to learn from that, or I want to believe that he learns from that.
And you know? I think that becomes evident when he makes up with Rat later.
Yeah.
He's like, look, you're my only friend, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to lose a friend. But, and that's where I was like, really? Like, you stay friends with this guy after he, you know, slept with, knocked up, and then abandoned the girl that you like, you know? Mm-hmm. That was a stretch, but I can totally see it happening.
I think given the situation, given the dynamics where Rat comes out of that fairly well, you know, and again, it's sort of like this, it's a mirror of what Stacy goes through,
right.
You know, where his mentor has really been exposed as kind of a fraud and a jerk, you know? So I think by superseding him, he can kind of like, you know, well, yeah, of course we're friends, you know, because now you can't hold anything over me.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So it's a lot easier for him that way.
Yeah, but totally. I read about, you know, Sean Penn and his, I guess he's always been like this super sort of method guy, because apparently he stayed in character as Spicoli throughout shooting.
Which is it's fantastic.
And they put, like, instead of his name on his dressing room, it said Spicoli, and you know. I think it's a I the best role I've ever seen him do.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah. I've never seen him do a character that had so much heart, you know, that didn't feel like a...
overwrought?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it felt very genuine.
Yeah.
And honest. That was, apparently he did a lot of stuff on set, too, to, like, improvising to try to get reactions from people. The other part that really surprised me and didn't go where I thought it was going to go was the robbery at the at the gas station or the convenience store. I thought, oh my God, is this movie about to get really dark? Like, I thought I was expecting this super dark sort of ending. I was like, oh my God, Brad's going to get shot. And or Spicoli. Someone's going to, I was sure, like, someone's about to get shot. Because, and it's a, such a great, like, bookend to the first, or to one of the early scenes with Brad, where he's dealing with that customer who didn't like their breakfast.
Yeah.
And he's like, I just have to find this form, you yeah. know, and he can't find the form. I just gotta
figure out how to do this.
And then, you know, the answer to that scene is later, he can't find the safe combination or whatever.
Yeah.
And the guy's freaking out, and then Spicoli comes out. He grabs that pot of coffee and just like, I was like, oh my God, he wins, you know? And then Spicoli's reaction is so great.
Classic.
Why don't you get a job, Spicoli?
What for?
You need money.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine. Thanks. Can I use your bathroom?
Yeah, go ahead. It's the first door on the left.
Like up this ramp?
First door on the left.
When do you think one now?
Okay.
What are you doing? It's safe! Behind the donuts! I'm watching this place. I know what I'm doing. Open it up. Open it up!
Okay.
Come on!
I just started here. They just taught me the procedure, and I let me figure it out.
Shithead, let's go! Get off my case, motherfucker!
Hey,
no towels, man.
I got you, you son of a bitch!
And, but yeah, I, again, like, because of every other movie I've seen, I was expecting this suddenly to sort of turn dark and to, for us to have a very serious moment, you know.
I think it's the interesting that that being the denouement or whatever, he you sort of want, like, Brad's fortunes to turn around,
yeah.
You know, you want him to, like, eventually get the dream job, you know, like, right. He thought that All American Burger was the dream job, yeah. You know, but in reality, you know, he eventually gets it, but he does it.
Yeah.
You know? He ends up in, like, even worse than the pirate, the seafood place, you know, he's working the night shift at this convenience store that gets robbed, you know?
Yeah.
But he does have that little victory, you know, when he wins.
Yeah, and he's so excited
too. Yeah.
When he wins, it's great.
Yes.
Oh man. Was that one of, when did, I guess Animal House came out before that, right?
Yeah, a couple years. It was I guess sort of riding a wave of the that type. Like Animal House was maybe first, and like Meatballs and Porky's. I think those had all come out.
Because Animal House does the thing where at the end it tells you what happens to the characters later.
Yeah.
And like Brad ends up being the manager of that guest.
Yeah, yeah. I love how like how finite and very nearsighted those futures were. Yeah. Like it wasn't like, you know, 10 years later, Brad's married to so and so and everything. It was like, you know, 6 months later, Brad's the manager.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. They did make a sequel to Fast Times.
They did?
Well, it's like a loose sequel.
What's it called?
It's called The Wildlife, I think.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually like Cameron Crowe wrote, I think he might have directed it too. But it's like, it has like, Chris Penn is like Spicoli's cousin or brother or something. And there's a couple of other people in it. And I'm trying to remember. Okay, no, Cameron Crowe just he just wrote it. It was okay. Directed by somebody else. But it's like it's a little darker and also like not nearly as well articulated.
When was it made?
84. So wow. It was like 2 years after Fast Times.
Is anyone from the original in it?
They're actors are. Characters are not, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe it's not actually considered a sequel. Maybe it was just the fact that it was like Cameron Crowe made it. Never mind. Forget the sequel part. I read the book not too long after I had seen the movie.
Was the book written first?
Yeah. So the whole thing started, Rolling Stone paid Cameron Crowe. He was a freelance writer for Rolling Stone. And I don't know if this was his idea or Rolling Stone's idea, but he was young enough to get by as a high school student.
Like, he
could pass for a high school student. So he went undercover in a high school in L.A. and then wrote Fast Times, the book, based on it. And I think the book is sort of like a composite of actual people that he met.
Yeah.
So he tells their stories in sort of amalgamations of actual people. But a lot of it does sort of carry over anecdotally into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like I swear there's like one of the things that's scrawled on the dugout that says like disco sucks or whatever. I think that's actually in the book.
Yeah.
But that's sort of it. Like the movie even further kind of compresses, you know, characters.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's like maybe twice as many characters in the book as there are in the movie. But and I wonder if that probably had something to do with how realistic it feels, you know, it being more of a documentary influence.
That dugout scene is...
That's...
Again, you're just like, all right,
man, Ron Johnson, what, like stereo engineer or something like that. Like he has a business card.
Yeah, did he have a card that he gave her?
Oh, man.
And Linda was like, oh, yeah, go
that's
for it.
That's the guy,
man.
Yeah.
That's the guy you want. And it's just like, wow,
yeah,
this guy. And he sent her flowers.
Yeah. Yeah, he sends her flowers.
Wow. And then Brad gives them to his... That was the other thing I loved. His introduction to the movie is great because he walks in all smiles and his photo is up on the employee of the month. Or whatever.
Yeah.
And he kisses his girlfriend like she's mid order with some someone and he kisses her.
I love that he's like, it's like the middle of the night, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever. And he's like just coming into work.
Yeah.
Maybe he was on break. I don't know. But yeah. And you see him in the mall too.
Yeah.
I think like he's walking around the mall.
Right.
And he walks from there into work.
Yeah. And that one dude wants to work at, what's it called? American
Arthur,
Burger.
All American Burger.
Yeah. He's like, can you get,
he's like,
where's he working before?
He works at Bronco Burger. Yeah. What's the secret ingredient of Bronco Burger? Thousand Island dressing or whatever?
Well, no, I think all American burgers, Thousand Island.
Oh, yeah.
Bronco Burger is ketchup and mayonnaise.
Yeah, yeah. he puts his hand on his shoulder. He's like, Arthur, it's okay. You can tell me. You want to work at all American Burger.
Oh, man. And then he goes to the bathroom or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's when that customer shows up. He's like, oh, we had a great time as he's leaving after getting fired.
Yeah, that's an excellent scene, too.
Man.
I'm going to kick 100% of your ass.
He has so many like outbursts unexpectedly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he seems to be this sort of happy-go-lucky dude, and then when he's, like, pushed to a breaking point, he sort of explodes.
Snaps. Yeah, erupts.
Like the pirate thing or whatever. That's great when he looks over and he sees this woman and he's sort of like, oh, hey. Yeah. And then she laughs at him and he realizes why. And he just throws everything out the window.
I love what she's wearing, too. That, yeah. She's got like that, a like, fuzzy, two-tone Angora sweater thing.
That's the that's Cameron Crowe's wife, I think.
Oh, from Heart?
Yes.
Nancy Wilson?
Yeah.
I think? Huh.
Yeah.
Man, I read that in the trivia. Interesting. Did you notice the Molly Ringwald cameo?
No.
That actually is not Molly Ringwald.
No.
Yeah, I found that out. I always thought it was Molly Ringwald, but there's a scene where one of the Pat Benatar girls.
Okay.
Like who's in the movie throughout the movie? Like she's the omnipresent Pat Benatar.
There's three of them though, supposedly, right?
Right. Well, they're at the school, but there's one that you keep seeing. Okay. Like, she's in the science class and then she's also in she goes on the tour with when they look at the cadaver or whatever.
Yeah.
Mr. Vargas, I think. Yeah.
That guy.
Yeah.
Who was also
Switched to Sanka. Be gentle.
I believe he was also in Ghost.
He was the train ghost, wasn't he?
Yeah. He's, again, like, you're expecting him to be this sort of, and he was weird, but you're expecting this weird, like, teacher that no one likes, and he's just like a dude who, you know. He likes teaching.
You expect his weirdness to be more significant.
Yeah, or more sinister even.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not. He's just weird.
He's just a happy-go-lucky guy.
And like then his science. Wife. His wife is this beautiful woman. And Rat and... is it Rat and
Arthur?
Arthur are like transfixed.
Yeah.
And I think Arthur is like shaking her hand.
Yeah.
And she has to like yank her hand away. Pat Benatar is Molly
looks
Ringwald?
Like Molly Ringwald, yeah. And I actually looked this up, like, it's a pretty common question.
Really?
Like, is Molly Ringwald in Fast Times? And it's not. I think she was significantly younger.
Yeah, she would have been much younger.
She was on
Facts
of Life at the time, I think. Or, you know, shortly before that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people. There are a lot of, like, in addition to the people who like became big, you know, like the Nicolas Cage or Sean Penn or whatever, there's a lot of people. This is another reason I love the movie. There's a lot of people who didn't become huge, but were like fixtures of 80s movies.
Yeah.
Like one of the cheerleaders, one of them was in Night of the Comet, and then the other one was in Sleepaway Camp 2.
Okay.
Sleepaway Camp 2. Brad's girlfriend is Tina from Nightmare on Elm Street, the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, right.
So there's all these, like, I mean, it is a nexus of
the
80s
and
cinema.
And Mr. Vargas, he's in all sorts of...
Yeah, he's everywhere.
...movies. That face, you know,
gets
a lot of play.
Yeah,
there's all... Eric Stoltz, like we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Who, and not, you know... Not to bring him down, but probably gives one of the worst performances in the movie. I just think he's totally unbelievable as a stoner.
Yeah.
I was, and I think he auditioned for Spicoli.
God.
Originally.
Imagine, like, how that would have turned
out.
He's
had two roles that he could have totally ruined.
They were, like, star-making roles. Yeah.
And that most likely the movie would not have been nearly as good.
Yeah.
But because he went up for the role and got the role of Marty McFly.
Yeah.
And almost, they shot scenes with him and just didn't work out.
From under him.
And then he almost got Spicoli.
Oh, God. Now I want there to be like some scenes of him like auditioning for Spicoli. Yeah. Awkwardly and like sort of failing, you know?
Oh, poor Stoltz.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love how Nicolas Cage is in it, but he doesn't. Like, he just appears.
Totally insignificant. Yeah.
But you know him. You're like, whoa, Nicolas Cage. That's his first movie, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the arcade.
Yeah. Wow.
Come on. It ends, the movie ends on the screen of an arcade game.
Yeah, yeah.
Missile Command.
Missile Command, yeah.
It says the end.
The end.
Yeah. Oh, man. Come on.
Perfect.
Perfect. I was very pleased with it in the end. I'm glad that I saw it, because even though it's definitely spurred the rest of the movies that came out,
yeah,
you know, in the 80s, like it stands apart from them regardless. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it is a cut above, because it wasn't like a joke.
Yeah.
You know, it was written to, this was like a story about real people.
It takes it seriously, but not too seriously.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. It's not overbearing. Totally. It's not a farce. Yeah.
Good job. Yeah. Everyone.
Yeah, everyone. Involved.
Everyone involved.
Everyone everywhere. Good job.
Is that it?
I think that's it.
Man, so that's the end of the 1982 Retro Spectacular. Are we going to do a 1983 Retro Spectacular?
Absolutely.
Oh, cool.
Of course we are.
So you can look forward to that in the new year.
Yeah.
But for now, we'll put all four of these, because we get out the old other ones.
Yeah.
When we do it, the Retro Spectacular, we pull out the previous episodes for reference.
Sure.
And so we do, because, you know, we referred to Grease too.
Here. We did, yeah.
Before we wrap this up, do you think we can apply some kind of theme to the four movies we've chosen? So we did Grease 2,
mm-hmm.
E.T., Blade Runner, and Ridgemont.
With the exception of Grease 2.
Oh!
And you'll understand this. Why? I think you can argue that they were all three of the others were sort of trendsetters.
Yes.
You know, they were distinct.
And they sort of started a whole thing. They
created a subgenre unto themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't think you can say that about Grease 2. unless maybe you argue that Grease 2 is like the first abysmal sequel that everybody enjoys anyway, you know?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm sorry about Grease 2. I think totally we would have had a nice little package here.
Yeah.
Not for Grease 2. But it was a great, it's a fun episode. But it would have been a nice little playlist for people, mm-hmm. I think, if we had. Because you could have done like sort of chronological in a way where you could watch E.T. first, because that's, you know, kids.
Uh-huh.
And then you could watch Ridgemont, because that's high schoolers. And then you could watch Blade Runner, because they're all grown up. But Blade Runner would have... So what we needed to do, and sorry everyone who listens... Listen to the show. Well, we needed Blade Runner was the end of
that
life.
Should have been the end of it, yeah.
Right?
So we needed a
we
a
needed
third
a,
chapter.
Sort of a adult life chapter.
Like a parenthood story, yeah. Maybe.
Kids, teenagers, yeah.
Yeah.
Parents, death. and you know, those the people who played teenagers in Grease 2 were parents.
Were probably parents, yeah. So they were at least 35
so,
or 40.
You
yeah.
know, take that as you will. All right. Put all these back into the archive. Let's get ready for the 1983 Retro Spectacular.
Yeah.